Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer and biographer, Philip Hoare, and we're talking about his book, Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea. Philip, welcome back to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
It's a huge pleasure for me too, Mark.
As I was telling you, I'm getting addicted to your writing. It's you know, people don't read enough creative nonfiction. I think people most think that's an you know, some kind of weird contradiction to have a creative nonfiction. Yeah. But talk to me about your writing first, because your writing, now that I've read two books by yours, I'm really used to your writing. How did you develop your style? And when did, that's tough to say. When did you develop your style?
It sort of came about gradually, really. I mean, I started out writing biography. I wrote biographies of sort of figures from the 20th century. I was really interested in sort of mid-20th century culture. And I realized I was getting frustrated at the fact that I had to exclude myself from the story.
Yeah.
That you know, quite often the way that you arrive by your information or your narrative is just as interesting as the narrative itself. And I realized that this notion of objectivity in writing is it's a kind of fiction in itself.
I absolutely agree. And you know, now that you talk about it in that way, you're actually being more honest with the reader. Because I know what your interests are, and you're slanting things by reading a book this way.
I think that's really true. I think there is a degree of honesty about it. Also, inclusiveness. And I, as I've got on, I really think that it's easy to impress people with information. You know, I've done all this amazing research. I've traveled. But actually, it's much better if you say, let's go on this journey and let's see what we can find. And this is what I think about this, but you might have other ideas. And that's funnily enough, for a writer, the sense that you're going along with someone rather than sort of mansplaining, rather than you know, it's so much more. When you're writing like that, you think it's a much more, you feel better for it because you kind of feel more generous, I suppose, in a way.
From a reader's point of view, I feel like I've gone on the trip with you.
I'm so pleased if that's the way it seems, because that's what I really. I mean, you know, last time we talked about Albert Durer, my book about Albert Durer, and that was really the case there, because, you know, I was going off to places in Europe and in America, you know, and seeing works, and I felt, you know, I wanted the reader to be standing by my side, you know, they're looking at me, isn't thinking, wow, this is amazing, wow, are we going to be thrown out for getting too close to the art? You know? that was really sequentially from sort of Leviathan, my book. In the UK, it's called Leviathan. In the States, it's called The Whale. Sort of that sense of, you know, because that book was Leviathan. The Whale was about following in Herman. I wanted to understand the whale, and it's really why I got to Rising Tide, Falling Star. Because I wrote that book trying to understand what Melville was trying to do.
Right.
Well,
first of all, there are certain touchstones in your books. The certain writers, certain people, that you really just keep gravitating towards. Melville is one of them. We might as well talk about Melville too, because he's very important in this book. First of all, what an odd writer! He started out. He wrote a couple of these trash books like Omo and Typee, which were sort of pop ups. Then he writes this huge allegorical novel about the whale. Then mostly nothing until almost the end of his life, and he writes Billy Budd.
Go figure. I mean, I love him because he's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's just like, what a great opening for a book, which I mean, I kind of regard Moby Dick as sort of nonfiction myself. But the great opener, call me Ishmael. So we're already on this journey. Call me Ishmael. Is that your name? We're not sure.
Right.
You know.
Right,
it's
right.
The great ambivalence. The sort of, I love the fact that Melville steps back from himself. He steps back from the story. And he says, he's taking us by the hand. He said, look, I know this is crazy, this story, but just stay with me. We're going to, you know, we'll get there, but there's going to be a lot of mad things happening on the way. and it is nonfiction. It is fiction, but I felt I wanted to get, and he's really infected me, actually, as a writer, you know, just as coming to New England, especially, you know, and that was really tied in with me discovering Melville as a writer and seeing how modern he is. I mean, he's not a 19th century writer. He's not even a 20th century writer. He's a 21st century writer. He's someone for the future. He's like, he has all this strangeness built into him and so it's really Melville that really tripped me into thinking that I could write nonfiction, but in a sort of fictional way.
Well, first of all, for a lot of people think they know Moby Dick, and if you've never read the book, the experience is very weird because it starts out as sort of one kind of narrative, and then a little bit about more than halfway through the book, it turns really like a dream. It becomes like this bizarre allegorical, like oniric thing that happens. And it's a deeply, profoundly wild and weird book.
Yeah.
Well, talk about Billy Budd, though. What a strange bracketing of a career.
Yeah.
Everybody talks about Moby Dick. In this book, in Rising Tide, Falling Star, you talk about Billy Budd.
Yeah, because that's kind of where once you've sort of done Moby Dick, or once you become infected by Moby Dick, you have to have some kind of closure. Because the end of Moby Dick, there's a spoiler alert, but Ishmael survives. he survives clinging onto Queequeg's coffin, and Melville leaves you out there in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, bobbing in the ocean, with this guy who you've been through this mad journey on, and he's on this carved coffin, and you think, well, what the hell happens next? You know, how did you get back? You know, why? What brought you to this state where you were able to write like that or tell the story like that? And it's because he's mixing himself. He's mixing Herman Melville with Ishmael, with someone else who's another kind of omniscient author, who is almost sort of panoptically looking at it all from above. And so then suddenly, you know, if you're on that journey with Melville, Melville says right at the end of his life, it's the last thing he does, he writes Billy Budd, Billy Budd is the backstory to everything in a way.
Yeah.
It features this handsome sailor who's a very mythic, like, sort of Icarus figure. We know he's being built up for a fall again, rather like Ishmael. But unfortunately, spoiler alert, he doesn't survive. And the character of Billy Budd himself is tremendously empathetic. He's this sailor who is loved by everyone, from the captain to the least amongst the crew, except by one person, as we know, who's the baddie. And so he becomes a kind of, and this is why you're so right about Rising Tide, Falling Star. Rising Tide, Falling Star is my Billy Budd to my book, The Whale, which was my Moby Dick. So it's me kind of looking back, how did we get here? The implicit sadness of Melville's life, the failure of his life in quotation marks, because of course he isn't a failure, he's the greatest writer of the 19th century, I would say. That notion of failure, and that's what he does with Billy Budd, because the Billy Budd is kind of the perfected person, but he has one flaw, he stammers. And with that flaw, Melville undermines all that kind of mock heroism, this homoeroticism, this sense of the mythic, and he undermines that by giving him this huge flaw. This, you know, he can open his mouth and then the words won't come out. What a fabulous metaphor for Melville himself, you know, who is buried in a Bronx graveyard with a blank scroll on his tombstone. I mean, nothing about that man, I think, ever doesn't surprise me. And it's like every turn in life, even in death, and I think he knew that Moby Dick would be what it was. I think he knew that from the way he, because the only right reader he ever had for Moby Dick, the only person who really got it was Nathaniel Hawthorne.
That's right. That's his friend that he actually had the conversations with.
Yeah.
The amazing thing is, for people who are listening, we're talking about one little section of the book, of this book, because this the overarching theme of Rising Tide, Falling Star is this meditation on the sea, its attributes, its denizens with humanity. And you come at it from all these different people. And Melville is certainly one of them. But it's the variety of people that you bring into this narrative that's sort of wild. Like, I want to make sure we talk about other things and other pieces. I want to talk about The Tempest. Now, Shakespeare's The Tempest, and like Moby Dick, it's a very odd play.
Yeah. And again, it's pretty much the last substantial play that Shakespeare wrote. He's looking back on his life through the character of Prospero, this magician, this alchemist, this conjurer of scenes. And, of course, the whole notion of the Tempest is just an invention. The storm isn't real at all, the storm that begins that. It's a magical storm that Prospero has conjured up. He sort of put the world in tumult. Everything is turned upside down. These kings and princes and aristocrats are on this ship who usually have control over everything. They've lost control. The workmen, the mate and the captain are saying, "You are useless. Get off the deck. You know, your earthly powers are no use at sea." And then that whole thing then becomes transmogrified into this wonderful thing where you have Ariel, who's this fluid spirit who, you know, talks about men's eyes have turned into pearls and their bones into coral made, and that great sense of transformation, the physical, metaphysical, allegorical, real sort of change that the sea induces, that sense of where we lose control, you know, the land has run out, law has run out, human control is useless. This is why I love the whale, way the whale takes us through, because the whale is almost human. It's almost, because it's mammalian and it's, you know, it shares the two worlds. It's the conduit, or it's the thing that breaks the two barriers, the liminal membrane between us and the sea, that it physically breaks that and metaphorically and allegorically breaks that. So,
one of the ideas that I got personally from this book is that the sea is just too big. It's too powerful. Mm. It's too complicated. It's this thing that is, you know, most of Earth is the oceans.
Yeah.
But we think we're going to do this with it or that with it, but in the end, it's all for naught. If there's a quote in your book, if there were no oceans, would we have souls? And that's a beautiful quote. That's an amazing quote. And the book starts with an ocean storm that you're personally witnessing in southern England. And you talk about the awesome chaotic power of it, and then the destruction of the seawall, which you end up taking personally.
Yeah, I do. As we speak, Mark, I've just come back from swimming in that same spot where I swim every day. I swam there at 2 o'clock this morning, so I swim in the dark, which is a very magical thing to do.
Yeah.
Kind of crazy and strange. And but because I feel that place, I mean, I know, because I go to it so often, I go to it almost in my sleep, in my dreams. It was a big full moon this morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, so it was a you know, it looked like a Caspar David Friedrich painting. It was incredibly sharp and strange and surreal. And it sort of has become an extension of my body. I know every stone on that beach almost, you know. I know it in the dark as well. And it's that, it's a sense of occupying this another kind of liminal space, which is the nighttime. And nighttime, and I live in this. I live in suburbia. It's not a great wilderness. I'm near the sea, which is a wilderness, and there's a large forest, the New Forest of Southern England, which is just across the water, which I can see from across the water. But I'm in suburbia. But suburbia is transformed in the late night and the early morning. So when people have stopped coming home from nightclubs and the pub and everything, and people are being put to bed, and then the animals take over. So there are foxes and deer and rabbits and bats and owls. And they're in ordinary, this is not, as I say, it's a suburbia. But it takes very little to get rid of the human. And the sea is the most inhuman thing, which is almost, is also kind of alive. It's an animal itself, the way it rears up, the way it reacts to me as I feel it, and the way that you know, I my youth is spent in clubs, nightclubs. I used to manage punk bands. I was a punk. My life was all underground. I was a troglodyte. But now I meet that, my young self coming back. I'm coming back from a nightclub as I'm going out now to the
right,
scene, which is my new kind of entertainment. So, yes, I do, you know, and I didn't learn to swim until I was nearly 30 years old. So it's all a kind of a rebirth for me, a kind of renaissance, I suppose, in a way.
Another quote from you in the book is that the sea accelerates yet stalls time. It has a strange effect on time.
All the movement of the sea, as we know, and all your listeners will know, that's all determined by the moon.
That's
and
right.
The moon is the first clock for human beings. It was the first time humans thought of greater time. So because the moon physically affects us, the gravitational pull of the moon affects the human body. You know, we know that, you know, women's menstrual cycles are influenced by the moon. We know that there are sets, certain people who the word lunatic comes from the moon.
Well, our body is mostly fluid, so
exactly.
Anything that's controlling the oceans is going to have some kind of weird effect on us.
It is, of course. I mean, I woke up this morning because of the full moon was shining my back, and it wasn't just the light of it, it's the kind of, it tugs at us. It tugs at us ourselves, you know. And so the sense the sea's tides become like that the greater clock in a way. So they, you know, anyone who lives by the sea or knows the sea or loves the sea, you know that there's this sense of it gives and it takes. It's there and then it's not there. And that's happening all the time. Nothing as yet that we can do affects that. You know, so there's a greater elemental power there, which is temporal and spatial and spiritual. And what that's, you say the quote about, you know, the thing I say about poetry. I do think that this sense of the literal profundity of the sea and the metaphorical profundity of it is something which you and I, as we talk now, we know there is that body of water out there which is such a repository of dreams, of nightmares, of food, of disease, of resource, of exploitation, of pollution, all these things it carries, you know. And I always think that, you know, when I go in the sea, I think that almost there's a homeopathic trace of me left from the last time I was there, as if, you know, as if it remembers me. When I was working on Rising Tide, Falling Star, I was talking to some oceanographers in the university here, the University of Southampton, and they were talking about how parts of the sea are older than other parts. So there are parts which might be 400 years old and parts which might be 4,000 years old. And that completely discombobulated me, the notion that actually this fluid element could be still. There are parts of the sea which don't really change. They are old. The surface is possibly new. I mean, it's a very strange thing to get your head around. You know, the notion, we know that there are sort of layers of salinity to the sea which give a different sense of body to it. I was very struck when I was in the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, there was a display of Pacific people's cultural imaginings of the sea. So there were maps of the sea made with cowrie shells.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So beautiful. And then this is a long ramble, but one story which really struck me is that how Polynesian people could tell where they were from the color of the sea, from the way it moved. And they would actually stand at the prow of the boat and rest their testicles on the prow of the boat, and they would feel the sea through their bodies.
Wow.
So that completely is a mind, you know, it's, you know, we think we're so clever with our GPS and everything, but, you know, a Polynesian person can tell where they are.
The amazing thing is how they transverse this huge Pacific Ocean from island to island.
Unbelievable.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer-biographer Philip Hoare, and we're talking about his book, Rising Tide, Falling Star, In Search of the Soul of the Sea. You, in the book, you talk about your time that you lived in Provincetown right here in Massachusetts, where, I like how you describe it, where America runs out. It's like, bang. and it, as is true for all parts of your writing, there are extraordinary people there who just are part of the fabric of the town, like Pat, your landlady, who's an artist who lived this amazing life with all these personages that are famous in Provincetown, and now she's still hanging out there like one of the old cottages.
Yeah. Sadly, she died 2 years ago, so the book is a real sort of love letter to her. She took me in. She was very suspicious of me when I started coming to Provincetown. I was there as a guest of John Waters, who's a friend. I came to visit him, and he introduced me to friends and people. And John Waters lived in Pat's house. He had a studio in her house. Her house is a series of artist studios, really. And it's built on the sea, but it's built over the sea. The sea actually, at high tide, spring tide, the sea goes underneath the house.
Wow.
That sense of Provincetown is really just a collection of arcs. You know, they're not, it's even when on the sand, the sand is fluid. Sand passes under these boats. There's a sense of just, it really, really just brings home to you how we are only just floating on this world. And, you know, we have very, when it comes to the sea, we have no control, really, in a way.
There's a great photograph of you with angel wings provided by a dead gannet.
Yes, exactly. That is, that's kind of crazy. It was my friend Dennis Minsky.
It's a great photograph.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. And Pat just, she sort of adopted me. She saw what I was trying to do. She said, you need to go and be with the whales. You know, you don't need to just see them. You need to be with them. And she, because in her 60s, she got to hang out with this orca in Cape Cod Harbour, Provincetown Harbour and Cape Cod Bay. And this orca, which is probably an escaped military-trained animal, we now think, was very, very habituated to humans. But she would go out there and feed it flounder to keep it. It was actually a female orca, to keep her hanging around Pike's kayak with a laundry marker, an indelible laundry marker, would draw this orca. And there was this fantastic connection between Pat, who is a wild animal herself. She's kind of half wolf, half seal. I don't know. She was a feral person. And she reacted against her mother's background. Her mother was very wealthy, an interior decorator. She was best friends with Truman Capote. A few generations back beyond that, I don't even remember the movie Titanic. There's an elderly couple who refused to get on the lifeboat, and they sort of curl up on their bed and decide to die. Well, that was the Strauss family who owned Macy's and who were Pat's great-great-grandparents. So she came from a very interesting background. She rejected all that because she wanted the freedom of the sea in Provincetown. And she was a wonderful artist. She painted the same view out of her studio window. It's the same relationship of sea and sky, the same kind of two-thirds sea, sky, one-third sea, and she just painted it obsessively in these very meditative, almost Buddhist images, just very impressionistic. But yeah, she transformed my life. She would wake me in the middle of the night to see the moon, you know.
Wow.
Come into my bed. And she was quite right, you know. She said, what are you doing asleep? Look at the moon. And that's why I started swimming at night, you know, because I'd start getting tuned to the full moon and it would drag me out of my bed and I could actually sort of almost fall out from my bed in the house and into the sea.
Philip, we're completely out of time.
Yeah.
And we haven't really even scratched the surface of the book. And not only that, we haven't gotten to the part where I wanted to talk to you about Bowie. We're going to have to do that another time. My returning guest tonight is writer-biographer Philip Hoare. And we've been talking about his book. It is an amazing read. Rising Tide, Falling Star. It's all one word. In Search of the Soul of the Sea. Philip, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you so much for putting up with me,
Mark. Oh, yeah. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.